Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week we'll be speaking to one of my heroes and role models, S. Brian Wilson. Brian is familiar, I think, with most people who listen to this show, but now he's the subject of a movie called Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson and the peace movement. And I'm actually in that film, and they're trying to raise money to finish it. I think it'd be a very important work. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Brian Wilson. Brian Wilson, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you so much.
Well, Brian,
good to hear your voice.
Brian, you and yours as well. You know, how much I admire you and try to model my life after yours.
Oh, please don't.
I hope you, I know.
I fall all the time. I stagger on the path.
Of course, and that's because you're human, and that's what's great about you, because the path, when you stagger on the path, you're doing it on your prosthesis because of the amazing act of courage and love that you performed. That when you lost your legs and almost lost your life. And so I don't like people saying that about me either, but you know, I'm allowed to have my heroes and my role models, and you're one of them.
Oh, well, I don't know what to say.
Well, just, it's true. So, speaking of your amazing act of courage, which I know all my listeners know about, there's a documentary in production right now about your life and about your activism, and I think it's a project that's very worthy of supporting. So tell my listeners about it.
Well, there was a documentary filmmaker who read my book, Blood on the Tracks. He read it shortly after it came out in 2011. And he tracked me down and said he'd like to do a documentary. And he started filming in November of 2011. And he has been kind of, films have a life of their own as filmmakers begin developing the story. And he started interviewing lots, he probably has interviewed you too, I don't know.
Yes, he did.
So many people.
Apparently, I'm in the trailer, I'll post that when I post the show, the link to the trailer.
Okay. So he's been interviewing people in the peace movement. He's been interviewing he's filmed different actions. He accompanied Becky Knight to Nicaragua last summer. It was my first trip back after 19 years. He's got footage of me with the Sandinista soldiers from 1986, which was, you know, old footage. And it's called Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson and the peace movement. So he has so much footage, I don't even know how he's going to put it all together. He's hoping to get it together by this fall or even late summer. And he's on the final campaign to raise $35,000 to finish the film. He's put in almost $40,000 of his own money, and
wow,
he has raised some other funds, including an earlier Indiegogo campaign. So we're down to the wire. I think we've raised almost $9,000 in the current Indiegogo campaign. We're hoping for some, a few very good large contributions to put us over the top, but it's not my film, and I'm not a fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
I just happen to be, you know, one of the characters in the film, and I would like to see it completed. I think it'll be a great film, but, you know, films are films, and it's a very creative process to put a film together, and I'm not a filmmaker, so I don't know how to do things like this. And so I'm just, you know, waiting to, I'm hoping, encouraging Bo to proceed. And, of course, he's very committed. He's made 25 films, but he's never made one quite this political, so it's right. made fundraising a little more difficult.
Exactly. Well, I know Bo Bodart, we're talking about, came to our recent action in Washington, D.C., or Washed Up D.C., as I like to call it, called Spring Rising, and he set up a camera in one of the rooms, and he caught many of us there. So I thought
Great.
That was a brilliant move, you know, like Anne Wright and people like that. So I thought that was a good move.
No, he's got so many people on there. It's, it's going to be, you know, I'll be intrigued myself to see it.
Right. Very exciting. There was another filmmaker there doing the same thing, so that's going to be interesting. But Brian, today when the show airs, but it's not when we're taping it, it's Flag Day. And first of all, I'd like to have your thoughts on, I'll just be a little biased to show you my thoughts. I call it the bloody rag of empire. So what are your thoughts about the Stars and Stripes? And then I would like to talk about the book that you're writing currently. So what are your thoughts about the Flag Day and the situation?
Did you say Flag Day?
Yes, it's Flag Day.
Because the way your voice is coming across my phone, it's muffled enough. I'm not getting every word exactly.
Oops. Yeah. So today, when the show airs, is Flag Day. What are your thoughts about that?
About the flag.
Yes.
I think the United States flag is the most violent symbol on the planet. And it's one of the reasons I walked out of the courtroom as a young lawyer back in 1973, because I couldn't even look at the flag. And I used to carry our flag, the American flag, in our town parades when I was a kid. So, felt so betrayed by the symbolism of what it supposedly represents. So I see it as almost like a swastika to a German, I think. I think it's a very violent symbol. And, it's part of perpetuating the myth of America. And so that's how I feel about it. That For many years I didn't even hardly have the courage to tell people what I thought about the flag.
Right.
I mean, all through the 70s and 80s. But then I got to the point where I just had to tell people what I felt about it, about all the history that I'd learned, and that was a fictional tale called something called the United States of America, built on the genocide of the Indians and the Africans. And we don't realize how much pain, suffering, blood has been spilled to build what we call America. And we have this sense of exceptionalism, which is just a cover for, I have to believe it's a cover for deep insecurity and shame that we don't want to address, because it's too painful to address it directly and honestly.
A few years ago, a young veteran named Matthew Chéreau burnt a flag in front of the White House, and I know it caused a great crap storm in the, you know, in IVAW and Veterans for Peace. What were your thoughts about that? To me, I thought it was a courageous act of principle, but a lot of people in our movement violently disagreed with that.
Yeah, because I'm sure it has to do with strategy. Like, how many people does it turn off that you want to try to, educate or have an impact on? And so I do think it's a decision that people have to make about whether they, how to utilize the kind of revealing the dishonesty of what the flag represents. So I have such contempt for the flag and for the American political and economic system that I have to leave it to people, other people, to decide how they're going to address that, just like I have to address it.
Right.
I have to figure out a way to address it myself. I became so alienated from my own family because of my views about the flag and the country in the 70s. That's like 45 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't take a rigid position on how people should express themselves in this country, which is like a Disney World society. I thought it was a good action, but I understand why some people would say it's going to turn off people. But, of course, telling the truth and being honest is going to turn off people, for sure.
Right.
And the question is, I guess, the manner in which you choose to express yourself. And I guess, however, people, if they thought about it and worked it through, there's probably no correct position about it. It's all correct.
Right. I was watching, the TV was on, and my grandchildren were in the room, and a commercial for McDonald's came on, and we don't go to McDonald's. And, you know, Ronald McDonald was trying to comfort a little girl, and so he was going to comfort her by giving her a Happy Meal. And so I was saying how Ronald McDonald was pushing poison on the little girl. And, you know, my grandchildren understand that because we don't go to McDonald's. And my 5-year-old granddaughter told me that that wasn't very polite, what I just said about Ronald McDonald. And that's exactly what I told her. I said, honey, sometimes the truth in this society is not polite, but truth is truth. And Ronald McDonald is trying to poison that little girl, so.
Yeah, you have to, I mean, it's a very difficult culture to live in because it's all built on pretend. It's all been built on lies. And to unravel from it and to try to kind of share one's perspective about how deeply, how ingrained is our brainwashing, it's really a challenge. I'm constantly challenged living here and trying to express my truths. It's just, even among people that I sometimes consider my dear friends, I sometimes feel I'm alienated from.
Yes, I understand. I totally understand that. Have you ever thought of expatriating yourself?
Yes, I've thought about it. I have an open invitation always to move to Nicaragua.
Right.
But of course I don't speak the language, even though I've tried several times to study Spanish in school. I feel pretty foolish and I'm so unable to grasp the language. It's not even that complicated of a language.
Right.
Sometimes I think when I'm in my Buddhist mindset or heart set, that wherever you go, there you are.
Right.
So it's almost like it doesn't matter where you are. It's a matter where how I'm feeling deep inside of myself, and not attaching to any particular outcome, even though I have desires for certain outcomes. Not to attach to them so that I'm going to be so depressed if my outcome doesn't happen. So I think in a spiritual sense, one has to decide where to, where their place is, where their physical place is, and then walk from that perspective or that place, that center, that groundedness, wherever you are. So, but I've definitely thought about it. I've thought about going to Canada. I've thought about going to Nicaragua. I've thought about going to Asia. But I am still right here in the United States, and happen to be in Portland, which is not too bad
right.
if you're going to be in the United States, but
right.
has its own problems. I just don't like living in capitalist society. It's just it's savage. It just contaminates everything. So I try to find my network of people and my lifestyle that I try to, you know, navigate. You have to be a kind of a creative gorilla to live here, I think. And that maybe is important, to live here as a gorilla. But I also believe in nonviolence. And nonviolence is not necessarily a outward behavior, which it is, but it's much more importantly an inner place, an inner feeling, an inner attitude, and I have to constantly practice working on that.
What do you feel about being believing in nonviolence? To me, I think is in my own situation is different from being a pacifist, because I would think that I also practice nonviolence, but I don't consider myself a pacifist.
Yeah, that's right. I do think of myself as a pacifist, but I don't preach it. I mean, it's just my how I think. I think where I'm at, but it doesn't matter to me whether people are pacifists or what they are. Actually, I don't even think that. I mean, even violence. How do we define violence?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we can really get into big arguments about that, and I certainly don't tell other people how they should respond to violence that's being inflicted on them.
Right.
Whether they live in another country or whether they're here. I can't judge anybody unless I'm really, literally in their shoes. So when I say I believe in nonviolence, I'm believing in nonviolence for myself. And I think that is a position that's probably pretty important for if we're going to survive as a species, but I can't mandate it, I can't dictate it. All I can do is try to model it.
Right. So, and that's why you're my role model, one of my role models. But anyway, Brian, what you're writing a book, and we've talked about it before, but this book has great significance and interest to me, and I can't wait to read it, but I will wait because I have to. So talk a little bit about the book that you're working on right now, because I think it's so important.
Well, it's been such a struggle writing this book. I was provoked into writing the book. I'm tentatively calling it Please Don't Thank Me for My Service.
Right.
And the subtitle is, I don't even know what the subtitle is. It's Full Disclosure. I'm gonna find it here.
Okay.
It's a Full Disclosure, a documented history of the United States' exceptionally grotesque and systematic crimes against the peoples of Southeast Asia, and the extraordinary, incredible resistance that emerged from within the military and civil society. So it's a history book with a lot of sources. And then there's a whole section about my own experience in Vietnam, somewhat graphic, actually. But it goes into the history of the formation of the United States. See, I have to set out the context itself is 100 pages. The history, the Cold War, which is a more specific version of a certain aspect of our history, which set us all up. And, well, I should say it set me up, and I suspect it sets most of us up, into a belief system that isn't rooted in reality. And I have to lay that out for the reader. I don't even know if it's going to be of interest to the reader, but I start out by saying Obama plans to fictionalize history because in 2012 he issued this Vietnam War proclamation, a 13-year campaign with $65 million to basically rewrite the history. I'll read you what the words from his proclamation. As we observe the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War, we reflect with solemn reverence upon the valor of a generation that served with honor. We pay tribute to the more than 3 million servicemen and women who left their families to serve bravely a world away. They pushed through jungles and rice paddies, heat and monsoon, fighting heroically to protect the ideals we hold dear as Americans. Through more than a decade of combat over air, land, and sea, these proud Americans upheld the highest traditions of our armed forces. Well, I was so upset when I read that.
Right.
And I stewed on it for a long time, and finally I decided after about 2 years, I said, well, there's other people doing similar things. I said, I just have to write my own response. I just have to write, I have to talk about what was the war about and what was behind it and how did we fight it and why did we had no, absolutely no moral or legal authority to even be there. And so I go through this history and I talk about the psychic damage of the Cold War that affected all of us. And then a whole section on the history of U.S. intent to make sure that the Vietnamese autonomy didn't happen. And then into the overt invasion and the chronicle of what I call barbarism. And then a whole section on anti-war activities, civilians and veterans, and its intersection with the civil rights movement. And then a whole section on the anti-war movement within the military. Pages and pages of showing what different soldiers were doing, kind of at the same time as the domestic resistance. And then I have a whole section on my personal Vietnam experiences, including a diary of several of the most intense months I was there, where I really had my epiphany. So, you know, it's got, because it's a resource, it's a source book for educators if they want to respond to the Pentagon's, because the Pentagon's writing history curriculums for high schools and junior high schools and colleges. So this would be a response to that. This would be an alternative perspective. I got 1,400 footnotes in it, but I think I'm gonna pare that back. Not the information, but it's a lot to have all these footnotes at the bottom of all the pages. But I felt like I had to make sure I was on solid ground when I'm challenging the government's position. So I got it pretty much the first draft done, 365 pages, 367 pages, I think. And I feel very insecure about it, I can tell you. It's been very challenging to do this. Mm-hmm. And I have no publisher lined up. I may self-publish it, or I may work another year in trying to find a publisher. But I have felt pretty insecure about the whole thing because it's been a tough thing to put both together. I've been working on it for about a year now, and I don't know what to say about it, except I put a lot of time in it, and it's got a lot of information in it, and a lot of history, and a lot of interesting stuff. But whether it'll be whether anybody will be able to read it or want to read it, or whether they'll be able to find it to read it, I mean, I think of all that, I think, oh my God, what am I doing? And so,
I think it's like so important, and I'm just glad that there are people like you who can bear witness to the truth about what Vietnam was about and what this nation is about, that are still here with us, that can actually, you know, refute what you know, that proclamation of Obama's. And I just think it's so important. And I've self-published my last several books. If you need help doing that, I'd be happy to help you with that, because it's
well, I have a great assistant
in, oh good,
self-publishing, and I have a great assistant for self-publishing, and that's my partner Becky.
Oh good.
She's really good at she's just really good at doing anything in the computer and formatting and all that, which I don't know anything about.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, that's the big thing, is formatting for self-publishing.
Yeah.
But I really recommend that, because you have more control, and you might not sell as many copies, but it's all, you know, it's all under your own control at that point. But I just really,
I have submitted this draft to a professional editor and paid her money.
Uh-huh.
To
I do
give
that
me a
also.
Lot of suggestions and,
right.
and make a lot of edits and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So I have gone through that process.
I also have a professional editor look over my books before formatting and things like that.
That's but good,
Brian. I know it's really hard to, it's, you know, writing a book about your own experiences and things like that. It does take a lot out of a person, and I just really like can't tell you how much I appreciate that you're doing this. I just think like things like Flag Day and things like the rewriting history based on fiction is something that we need to do. We need to expose that so much, so, you know, our young people don't become absorbed in into this horrible empire. And I just, I'm sorry it's been hard for you, but I just think what you're doing, it's just so important.
Well, you know, I'm just walking on the path, and it just kind of has its own, almost has its own gyroscopic energy. You never quite know where it's going. I kind of know what my intentions are,
right.
But I just have to have faith in the universe that somehow, when I'm doing something that's coming out of my energy or my heart or my chi energy, that it has a reason for it, and that it's okay to just do it, even if I don't know where it's going or what's
right.
going to happen.
Right.
You know,
well, just, I appreciate that you're open to the unknown also, because I think that's where healing and knowledge come from. And, you know, I hate to use religious words, but almost grace is,
uh-huh.
is that.
Yeah.
So,
well, my first book, my big book, Blood on the Tracks,
uh-huh.
And I still get people telling me what a wonderful book it is, but it hasn't gotten that much distribution. I think maybe 5,000 copies. And it's, so, I mean, you know, that was a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's really, and that, I did have a publisher, but, and I still have people come up and say, wow, that book
right.
is so incredible.
Absolutely.
And I said, well, there's not too many people that have read it, but I did my best. I mean, you know, you have
well,
to live in a capitalist
society.
Well, maybe not
so many bought it, but more read it than bought it.
So, what's that?
Maybe more people read it than actually purchased
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, it's in libraries and stuff
right.
like that.
So, Brian, do you have any links for people? I will post a link for on the newsletter, but for people who maybe don't come to this program through the newsletter, do you have a link for the for the fundraising page for the movie, for the film?
Well, it's an Indiegogo. I guess you could find it. It would be Indiegogo paying the price for peace, maybe.
Okay. And I said, I will put the link, and, you know, people are listening to this on the computer most of the time, so I think they're pretty sophisticated in going and finding things. Do you have anything
when
you'd
go
like
to that link, uh-huh. It's called Final Production for Paying the Price for Peace.
Final Production.
Indiegogo. There's a 4-minute trailer there, which is a new trailer on top of the older 9-minute trailer, which I don't know whether that's still on there. But it's still available on YouTube, the 9-minute trailer, which was pretty darn good, actually. And the new one isn't too bad either.
Awesome.
I don't really know how to identify these links. I'm not very savvy with the computer.
I think people listening to the show, we can find, like I said, it will be on the newsletter and on my blog. But just so people who, you know, who listen to it that don't go through the soapbox, they'll at least have some idea where they can go look for it.
Yeah, yeah. But definitely Indiegogo, Paying the Price for Peace, I think, is Final Production, Paying the Price for Peace, Indiegogo would... If they do that, they'll find it.
You know the Vietnam veteran Mike Hasty, right?
Yeah, he's a good friend.
Absolutely.
Here in Portland.
Yeah, I just got an email from him, and I haven't heard from him in a long time. But while we were speaking, and the subject line is United Mistakes of America.
United Mistakes.
Yeah, United Mistakes of America.
Yeah.
So say hi to Mike. See him, and say hi to Becky and all our friends up there, and keep up the good work, Brian. And it was really great to talk to you again and have you on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Well, thanks for thinking of me, and say hello to all your friends, too.
We'll do that. We'll do that. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox for this week. I'm sorry for the sound quality of that interview, but I'm sure you'll agree that the quality of that interview was certainly high. And we were going to premiere this show on Flag Day, but the TPP and TPA vote came up. And as we're speaking, the House has passed their version of the TPP, and now it's at the Senate. So, I mean, like we said in last week's show, it just highlights the hypocrisy of empire. Obama's working with the Republicans to get something that really the establishment wants passed. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, for just being an amazing engineer, and also for his work and his support. I'd like to thank my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller. I'd like to thank Brian Wilson for his lifelong commitment, well, his decades-long commitment to peace. And we're going to end the show with a song by our friend, David Rovix, my friend and friend of the Soapbox, and it's called Charleston. So listen to Charleston. I'm Cindy Sheehan. Peace out for now.
He was listening to voices talking in his head. If you grew up in America, you know exactly what they said. And with every job we lose, however bad things get, there's a black man in the White House on the TV set. And we can blame it all on him and his entire race, because they no longer know their place. You can hear the voices and And by the early light of dawn, you can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. He was listening to voices. You could say that he was crazy for thinking certain people are just born to be lazy. He could see it on the cop shows. They don't know right from wrong. The race war is coming, and now it won't be long. I promise it was not his original notion. If you want to start a war, first you have to set the war in motion. You can hear the voices by the early light of dawn. You can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. He was listening to voices who said the conflict's coming soon. And he walked into the church on the 17th of June, on the very date of the rebellion that never was to be, for which 35 were hanged in that very city, for which the church was burned, for which the church was banned, for which there's been no atonement in a sick and troubled land. You can hear the voices, and by the early light of dawn, you can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. You can hear the voices by the early light of dawn. You can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. You can see the flag waving on the state house lawn.